Absolutely, because one like super tangible thing is that because I had that funding like monthly, and also being in Columbia, Missouri, be it a very to me small town, because I come from a big city, but to them I don't think they consider it a small town. But being in a small town that is not very diverse, like pretty like one of the whitest places that I've lived, it was in important for me to have moments to be able to just like escape and go visit my family when I was really missing them. So having that stipend, and also living in a place that was like lower cost of living, I was able to manage like, paying my rent and still be able to save money to leave, during times when I really felt like, okay, I need to get away.
Welcome back to the Covert Sisters podcast, where we give voice to the stories, struggles, and successes of Black women with doctoral degrees. I'm your host, Dr. Ijeoma. Our guest today is Dr. Robina Olongwa, who received a PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Missouri-Columbia. A Maryland native with roots in Kenya, Dr. Olongwa shares her journey as the first in her family to achieve a doctoral degree and discusses her research on the long-term effects of childhood trauma. From her unique upbringing to her advocacy as a Black psychologist and executive leadership consultant, Dr. Olongwa's story is one of perseverance and empowerment. Join us as we uncover the profound connections between adverse childhood experiences, ethnic identity, and psychological well-being. Let's dive into this inspiring conversation. Welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast, Dr. Robina Olongwa. It's so exciting to have you back in Connected with Cohort Sisters. We had you as a panelist for our Black History Month workshop, talking about how you navigated being the first in your family to get a doctoral degree. So congratulations on that in and of itself.
Thank you.
Of course. I'd love for you to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and where you currently live now.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited to be here. Glad that I found Cohort Sisters while I was in grad school. And even though it was towards the end of it was really helpful connecting with a community of other Black women scholars. So I'm Robina Nwanga. I have a border crossing upbringing. I consider myself Amerikenian in that I was born in Baltimore. I grew up in Kenya, East Africa, for like the first 6 formative years of my childhood, and then I came back to the States, where I grew up in Prince George's County, Maryland, which we fondly refer to it as PG. And I'd also like to acknowledge that Maryland is occupies like ancestral lands of the Patuxent, Piscataway, Susquehannock, and I know a few others that I'm probably forgetting, indigenous nations. So yeah, I grew up around here. I went to the University of Maryland for undergrad, and I studied psychology and French, and I did some international studies as well. And I went to France to study abroad in Nice for like half a year, and that was a great experience.
I'm really jealous because my one regret about college was that I didn't do study abroad. I know this is not a podcast about college life at all, but like if I could do it again, I'm like, oh, I wish I had studied abroad and like lived a romantic life in France. I took French in high school, so I'm like, oh, I wish I had done. That's what I should have done instead of I don't know what I was doing in college.
Yeah, that was one thing
But
that I was like really adamant about wanting to do, so.
yeah, good for you, good for you. And also, of course, shared identities with, being, you called border crossing. I haven't heard that term before, but I like that term. Having a foot in two different places. And obviously I'm like, not obviously, but Kenya has a huge part of my life, since my husband is Kenyan and we've lived there for a while, trying to get ourselves back there.
Oh,
So
nice.
long story short, you're my sister, my Kenyan sister,
I love
and excited
it.
to be in community with you today. So can you talk to
Yeah.
us about what your doctoral degree is in and what you studied?
Yeah, of course. And I will say the phrase border crossing, I got that from Dr. Ty Douglas, who is one of my mentors while I was at Mizzou, and he uses that a lot in his research because he calls himself a border crossing brother. So but yeah, I got my doctorate in counseling psychology, and I went to Mizzou, University of Missouri. That's the flagship university for the institution.
And what did you research? What was your dissertation on?
Ooh, oh gosh. Like, I feel like I did that, was that only last year, and I already kind of am like past that. But yeah, I actually did a topic that was pretty close to my heart. So I'll share like the main question and what I explored and then like my reasoning behind it. So I was and still am curious about the impact of people's experiences during their childhood on their development across the lifespan. So I was specifically looking at adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, which are categorized as abuse, neglect, household dysfunction. And that was after I saw this TED Talk by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. She's a former Surgeon General for the state of California. And she, her TED Talk was on how childhood trauma affects health across the lifespan. So for my dissertation, I was specifically interested in the relationships among ACEs, ethnic identity, and psychological sense of community, or our sense of belonging to like a specific entity, and how that all connects to our mental health. So like satisfaction with life, positive mood for Black emerging adults in the U.S. And then the reason that I really wanted to embark on that is because through like the studies I was reading, I, you know, found out and, you know, obviously knew through lived experiences that it's a thing, but the research was also showing that exposure to traumatic incidents is pretty common, especially like in the U.S. So like 2/3 of people experience a traumatic event during their lifetime. And the CDC also had a study where they showed that 60% of U.S. residents reported at least one adverse childhood experience, and about 10% of the population reported four or more. And then I knew, like, through looking at more data that Black people were at a way higher risk than other racial ethnic groups for experiencing ACEs, which I'm sure you know as, like, a historian of race and medicine, that in a society where systemic oppression and structural racism is prevalent and pervasive, that Black people are at a disproportionately higher rate to be impacted by trauma, and for my case, specifically adverse childhood experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So at what point growing up did you become interested in psychology? And then can you talk us through the decision to specialize in counseling psychology, maybe versus clinical or developmental psychology or all the other versions of psychology? We'd love to kind of know like what brought you to this. I understand the research, but what brought you to the field in general?
Yeah, I would say like the first maybe formative memory or around the time where I had that first formative memory of like, this is a space that I want to go into was high school. And initially I was actually really interested in forensic psychology, you know, those shows that we see about like criminal minds, Law and Order SVU, how do people think and how does their thinking impact their behavior, mood, all those things. So that was my initial interest in it. And I was like, oh, I want to be like an agent and kind of look into that stuff. And then it got a little bit deeper for me where, so around the time I was in middle school, Kenya had gone through a lot of civil unrest with the elections that had gone on during that time. And I had family who ended up traveling to different areas outside of Kenya to seek asylum. And some family came here to the U.S. At that time, obviously, I knew it was like a huge thing, but I hadn't, you know, I didn't really have the mental capacity to actually conceptualize what was going on. So when I got to high school and I was thinking more about that and I got to take a psychology class in high school, I was like, oh, this is really interesting. And that kind of sparked my interest of like, okay, how is this trauma that people experience at such young ages? Like, what does that do to us growing up? How does that impact the way that people are within their families? I also at the time was like, had family members who had like mental illnesses, which I didn't really know about at the time, but I was like, okay, there's something going on here. And I just wanted to know more about it. So I ended up in, you know, experiencing all that and then taking the psychology class in high school. I was like, I think this is what I want to major in because it's interesting to me. And I want to continue to learn more about this and what I can do to contribute to helping. So at first, I actually, at the beginning of high school, I was like, I want to be a lawyer because I want to advocate for people in immigrant communities in that specific way. But then I realized that as a lawyer, I wouldn't be able to do some of the healing help work that I really wanted to do to have a better impact. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, as someone who also comes from a country that is, you know, plagued with like political trauma, yeah. I think that it's so important to for people to just kind of think about the different ways in which not only things that they experience, but things that their families experience, things that even your extended family is experiencing, can still very much inform how you move through the world and form and shape like what your interests are, but also like ways in which you need to heal.
I think
going in a completely different direction, but
yeah, I feel like there's a lot to be said of like our countries were both, you know, formerly British colonies. So there's a lot of like the vestiges of that, you know, trauma that comes up for how the countries are present day.
Right. And like not being able to not understanding all of that history when you're a child.
Yeah.
But I think as we continue to grow older and it becomes like more present and we are still seeing the ramifications of that, it is incredibly traumatizing, even though like we ourselves were not necessarily under colonial rule, but like we can, you still see the impact, you still see the residues of colonization on us. So it's like, it is really, it is troublesome.
Yeah, 100%.
So let's talk about your doctoral program. Why did you go to Mizzou? Why was that the right program for you? How did you end up there?
You did ask me why I chose counseling versus clinical. So when I was when I was in undergrad, my semester that I studied abroad was the last semester of my junior year. And while I was abroad, I remember like, you know, getting emails from like advisors being like, oh, you know, sign up for your next classes. And during that time, a lot of my peers were solidifying internships during the summer for their respective fields and stuff. And, you know, I was abroad, so I wasn't really thinking about that at the time until that started coming out. So then I remember having a friend who I used to do, I used to work as a community assistant, which is like the people who sit at the front desk and work with the RAs to give you the keys and make any emergency phone calls for students. And one of my coworkers at the time had mentioned that they were working on some research project, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. Sounds like a lot of work. Like, tell me more about that. And they were part of the McNair program. And so they told me about the McNair program, and then I ended up being, you know, like slightly interested at the time, but I didn't really have any true like research interest. I hadn't had much research experience. But whenever I was thinking back to what I could do for the summer, I remember them saying like it's a summer program. So I ended up reaching out to the program and applying. I ended up getting accepted. And so that I think was like a really pivotal moment for me, because that gave me a chance to have a summer research experience within the credibility of like a McNair program that was reputable. And then when it came time to apply to programs, the program director, Dr. Rhea Roper Ned, she's a Black woman, proud Howard University alum, she pushed all of us to apply to a certain number of doctoral programs. And so I ended up applying, and the program actually paid for whatever number she was telling us to apply for, they paid for those application fees. So that was very helpful at the time. So I ended up going to one of the professors in the psychology department. I've never had a class with her, Dr. Karen O'Brien. I saw that she had a paper on the outside of her door where she was like, this is for office hour. So I put my name down for an office hour. I went to the office hour, and I'm sure she was like, who are you? Like, I know I have a lot of students, but she seemed like the type of professor who knows like who her students are by name and stuff. So I just told her, I'm like, when I was doing some research for, you know, McNair, I saw that you work with, you've studied like women who've experienced domestic violence, and I'm interested in, you know, something that has to do with like trauma and how that impacts people. And so can I talk to you about like my interest in doctoral programs and stuff? And so she literally like took a yellow post-it note and wrote like maybe 6 or 7 programs on there with program directors and faculty that she knew, like she could vouch for, and was like, reach out to these programs and, you know, like that's a good starting point for you. And before she even did that, she actually asked me, like, what are your interests? Like, why are you thinking about going into psychology? And based on what I described, like giving her the whole background of like what I'm interested in, you know, trauma. I had done like a paper on like child soldiers in Sierra Leone and how that was impacting them. She was like, counseling psychology seems like a better fit for you because those programs typically have more of a social justice, multicultural emphasis than clinical psychology programs. So that was kind of the key thing that pushed me towards counseling versus clinical. And so then I applied to those programs, and University of Missouri being one of them is where her former advisee was the program director at. And at the time she was not accepting students, Dr. Lisa Flores, but she emailed me back and let me know that there are these other professors who have adjacent research interests to yours, and they could still mentor you through the program. So I applied to like 9 programs. I got interviews at 3. And when I went to do like that program specifically, it just felt like a really warm program, the way that she was leading it at the time. It just felt like a good fit for me. And also other like things that led me to feel like I divinely, that was like the divine order for me to be at that place.
Right. But also like, shout out to you for being like, you know, I want to do this. I need to figure out who's doing it. So I'm gonna sign up for this random person's office hours and get some face time with them. Because I think that sometimes we can kind of get in our head and be like, well, I don't want to bother someone. They don't know me. But you never know who is willing or able to connect you and to help you if you don't ask. So I think that is a really great, I'm so excited that you shared that testimony, really, of, and a testament to your perseverance and your determination that you, once you figured out what you wanted to do, you figured out a way to find the resources that you needed to get there. So shout outs to you for that. I hope other people kind of take that with them and are inspired to, you know, not be shy about reaching out to folks, networking, talking to people, because you honestly never know who knows who can refer you to where, et cetera. So shout outs to you for that.
Sorry. I will say that that was a really key piece, because I almost didn't reach out to those people. And even like getting into the McNair program was a huge like confidence boost for me, because I like literally failed my very first psychology class. I had to get like, I think at the time Maryland had like freshman forgiveness or something like that, where I had to retake my psychology class and I had to retake another course that was like probability, which were two major courses that were needed for me to actually continue on in the major. Otherwise, if I didn't pass them, I would have had to like select another major. And I remember when I was like asking about programs, there was a professor like pretty prominent in the field actually, who ended up looking at my GPA, and at the time I had taken the GRE as well, and he was like, yeah, I'm not sure that you're going to get into programs with these grades in, like, the main courses, like major courses, and this GRE, so you might want to do a little bit more, like, post back, and then, you know, try again.
Little did he know that was not your calling. That's wild. But there's actually one of the very first recordings that we did on the podcast. Dr. Mercy Agyempong, I hope I'm recollecting her last name properly, but she also spoke quite at length about, I think we had it even in the title. I think she had like a 2-point something GPA when she graduated college and then still went on to get her doctoral degree. And it was such a testament of the fact that, like, one, the grades and assessments are not a measure of intelligence. They're not a measure of willpower. They're not a measure of research ability. So sometimes those can also limit us, but we have to be able to push forward and not let what's on paper or what someone tells us is on paper to stop us from pursuing our academic dreams and goals if that's what we really want. So thank you also for sharing that additional context as well. So When you were at Mizzou, talk to us about some of the successes and some of the challenges. You know, what were the highlights of the program? What were some of the more rougher patches of the program?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my highlights has to do with like my initial like entry into the program. So in terms of finding funding, I remember when I was in undergrad, hearing grad students say like, oh, you shouldn't have to pay for, you know, like doctoral programs. At the time, I wasn't really paying attention, so I'm like, I didn't really know what they meant. I just knew that they were TAs and they were getting either paid or, you know, something for it. And so, like, one of the other things that helped me know that it was just divine orchestration for me to be there is that when I was interviewing for the programs that I interviewed for, I was pretty transparent with them about letting them know that finances was going to be a big barrier to me pursuing it. And I remember even telling, like, folks during my time at the interview at Mizzou that if I don't get funding, like, this is just not something I'd be able to pursue right now. My advisor at the time wasn't, obviously, like, I was interviewing with different people, but my person who had accepted me as an advisor, Dr. Christopher Slayton, he reached out to me and was like, hey, can you just, like, rework your personal statement to be more specific to this this fellowship, and then I'll submit it for you. I was still an undergrad at the time. I'll submit it for you and get back to you on the results of that. So reworked it, literally sent it to him like maybe within the same week. And then on my birthday that year, March 17, 2016, he reached out to me and was like, you were awarded a fellowship. It was the Gus T. Virgil Fellowship. It's supposed to acknowledge the first Black graduate student that Mizzou had. And I was given that fellowship that was going to cover my funding for 5 years and give me, like a stipend for 9 months out of the calendar year. And that was really a highlight because I still had to do assistantship jobs like during my time in the program, but I didn't have to worry about how my tuition was going to be paid. And I ended up graduating. I have loans from undergrad, but I ended up graduating from the PhD program with no loans and, you know, no stress on in terms of like how I'm going to make that up.
That is a huge success.
Yeah.
So how did that kind of motivate you? You know, even through the challenges, as you start to think about some of the challenges, you know, just knowing that your advisor advocated for you to get this funding, to get this additional funding, and then having like the weight lifted off of your shoulders about how you're going to pay for the program.
Yeah.
Was that one of the things that helped kind of shoulder you on through some of the lower points?
Yeah, absolutely. Because one like super tangible thing is that because I had that funding like monthly and also being in Columbia, Missouri, be it a very, to me, small town, because I come from a, you know, big city, but to them, I don't think they consider it a small town, but being in a small town that is not very diverse, like pretty, like one of the whitest places that I've lived, it was important for me to have moments to be able to just like escape and go visit my family when I was really missing them. So having that stipend and also living in a place that was like lower cost of living, I was able to manage like, you know, paying my rent and still be able to save money to leave during times when I really felt like, okay, I need to get away. So I was able to go home during the winter holidays. I sometimes would be able to leave and go visit like my cousin who also lives in the Midwest during like the fall break, just having time to actually leave. And that was possible because I had some of that funding. Like I know people who were not able to leave as often as they wanted to because they didn't have that type of funding. And so that's something that I'm really grateful for. And then also just like having the mental capacity to, you know, like handle everything else that was going on from research to, for counseling psychology, we have to do clinical work throughout the time of our program. Except for me, my first year, I didn't have to do that because I came straight out of undergrad. So my first year was just classes and work. But it really takes a toll on students to be doing clinical work and, you know, giving therapy or doing assessments in hospital settings and then having to switch gears to go to class and then switch gears to go to work. So knowing that I really didn't have to, you know, work an extra job like some people did, or I didn't have to really worry too much about that. I was able to spend that very limited mental capacity on those other things that were required.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because, because I think that when we often, for me, even myself, like when I think about the additional burdens and the additional labor that Black women often take on in order to complete their doctoral degrees.
Yeah.
A lot of us work through the program. And I've always thought about that as, you know, you're working. And so you, because you need finances, because maybe you don't have funding, that takes away time from you to be able to do your work. And so maybe that means that you take a little bit longer, mm-hmm. but I've actually never made the connection between the extra work and like the mental capacity. So I'm glad that you brought that up because there is like a mental fitness that you need to yeah. persevere in a doctoral program. And if you're navigating a lot of other different things, mm-hmm. then you only have so much mental fitness. Yeah. You only have so much mental energy. And if you're kind of like chopping it up into different pieces so that you can have a little bit of mental energy for work and have a little bit of mental capacity for your life at home. And like, maybe you're taking care of an ailing parent or dependents or something like that. So I've just always been thinking about it, working outside of a program as like a financial cost, and you've just helped me think about it as a mental cost too. Mm-hmm. So like I'm being enlightened.
What's that? That's Black tax?
Yes. Yeah. But I feel like we talk about it financially, but not emotionally mm-hmm. or mentally, but it is both an emotional and mental tax as well as a financial tax.
Yeah,
that was mind-blowing. Okay, maybe other people already knew that, but that was just new for me.
I guess it's more so putting words to that.
Yes, yeah, exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Yeah. Did you have any Black female mentors?
Sorry, we're going to talk about challenges.
Oh, challenges. if you want to.
I'll just highlight like a few because I feel like it is something that I don't know if at the time of my interview, a lot of students spoke about it, because when I was starting my program, they had Black women before me in the program, but at the time that I interviewed, mm-hmm. and for my first year or two there, I was the only Black woman in the program. There were Black men there who, you know, were like brothers to me and helped to kind of, you know, take me along. But when I first interviewed, like I felt the warmth of the program, the professors, the program director were very like kind and all, but I will say that just being in, I don't know, I feel like it's the doctoral experience to where for Black folks, mm-hmm. we're sometimes taken to these towns that are outside of our comfort zone, outside of our communities that we're used to being around, you know, very ivory tower space. Like it just, that is something that I don't think I was as prepared for. And so finding community and cultivating community during that time was really important. And the isolation that I felt, and I know that other graduate students felt, was very different to what it was to be an undergrad. Like an undergrad, you go, you're in this like utopia away from, you know, your, you know, your family that you're born into or whoever is taking right. care of you. And you feel like you have this freedom to do whatever and enjoy life. And in grad school, it's like, okay, you have these commitments. And even though I had a fellowship, my assistantship is like, they were working me for the money they're giving me, you know? So it's not like I had as much free time on my hand to do a bunch of things. But yeah, I had to be very intentional about how I was spending my time outside of the school related stuff so that I could make sure that my mental health was still in check, and that I still was able to, you know, like move along the program with some sort of sanity. And then it wasn't my experience, but I know during our program, there was so much restructuring that happened to where I had to step into like a student advocacy role and start to like speak up and demand certain things for myself and other students in the program. And that's something that is not accounted for in terms of like pay or, I don't know, acknowledgement or anything like that. And it is something that's going to, you know, continue in different programs, because once you kind of leave, the work that graduate students do, not much of it, unless it gets written into like the university policy, not much of it is very sustainable. So there was a lot of times where I feel like the work we were doing was kind of helpful in a way, but it almost is like it went to waste a little bit because the powers at the institution, they weren't as intentional or they didn't care as much to kind of keep that stuff going. So finding community really was like the main way that could help me to stay sane and to continue to keep going and feel like, okay, what I'm experiencing is valid, but I can't let that hold me down because I came here for a reason and y'all not gonna stop me from, you know, getting out of here with my degree. Yes.
Absolutely, absolutely. So when you finish your doctoral degree, can you talk to us about kind of how you were thinking about your post-career plans and then kind of lead us into the thought process as you were wrapping up to what you're doing mm-hmm. now?
Yeah, so with counseling psychology, typically, like the typical career trajectory is you graduate, you do an internship, which is like a year of solely clinical work. Some people might still be working on their dissertation during that time. And then you go on to do postdoc. And the postdoc would either be clinical. For some people, they do transition into research postdocs. But that kind of becomes the standard. Around like my third year of the program, I realized that I didn't want to do clinical work full-time because of how emotionally taxing it was, and I knew I wanted to do other stuff. Like, there's a lot of things that I feel like I enjoy doing and want to be able to use my degree and expertise and, like, natural, you know, like, God-given gifts to contribute to the world. And so one of those things was I wanted to do consulting, which encompasses like organizational or leadership consulting. And so I took a class, industrial organizational psychology class, which was required in our program. But it kind of perked my ears to like, oh, this is kind of interesting. I want to do more of this. And then I had a chance to be part of a project within the university system where we were sourcing vendors for executive coaches to come in and support faculty development at the provost and dean level. And through that, I was like, wow, there's really ways that I can use the skills that I'm learning as a counseling psychologist to impact folks in almost like a larger scale. Because with counseling, my thing was, okay, I can support individuals. At the time, I was doing a lot of work with children, and they have like practically zero autonomy over their lives. And so it was really sad for me to know with these kids at school, with these kids, you know, when they come into the hospital clinic setting, but they still go home to the environments that I'm doing research about, and there's not much that can be done. So I'm still working on like how to kind of have an impact in that way by trying to get my licensure so that I can still do some clinical work part-time. But during that time, I realized, like, I want to work with folks who have power to impact systems and impact more groups of people. And for me, it looked like working with organizations and leaders who are able to impact, like, policy and stuff like that, because then that has more of a trickle-down effect than working at the individual level. And so that's kind of how my interest started to bud for consulting. And then I ended up connecting with one of the people who I had connected with originally from that program of executive coaching. And I reached out to her just for like an informational interview. And she happened to be like, oh, we have this program, or there's this company that I do some contract work with, and they have an opening. Like, I'm going to give you the information for the partners and reach out to them and, you know, see, like, go from there. And so I reached out to them. She connected me with them via email. And my first meeting with them apparently was, like, I guess the first interview. So I did that. That's where I'm working now.
Nice. So you do consulting with this one company. Can you talk about how your degree and the research skills that you built through mm-hmm. the degree kind of like shows up in your day-to-day job?
Yeah, so the company is a leadership consultancy. We do like a number of different things. On my end, the talent management side of things, a big bulk of my work is assessing, helping organizations to assess and select talent for their organizations. And then at some point, we also help to develop them and help organizations figure out how they can retain some of that exceptional talent. And so what that looks like is they do the assessments, and I'm one of the people who interprets that. So in my training from Mizzou, I worked within a hospital clinic setting where I was doing assessments for parents who were bringing their kiddos in, or caregivers who were bringing their kiddos in for assessments of autism, other neurodevelopmental assessments, ADHD, stuff like that. So the basis of the assessment work and doing like the interviews with the families, that is something that I still carry over to now because it helps with my interpretation. It helps when I have the interviews with these C-suite leaders and just getting information out of them and trying to bring the assessment data to life. So I still use those same skills. And actually, I feel like even though I didn't get my PhD in IO or industrial organizational psychology, the skill set that I have as from the counseling psychology side is one that has been really helpful for me with the perspective that I bring to the organization and the work that I do now.
Did you feel like, was there a point where you said, no, I know I'm not going to do clinical work. I am not interested in teaching or additional research. I'm going to like look for a non-academic, non-clinical role. Mm-hmm. Or do you feel like it kind of naturally happened and that you were connected in this way mm-hmm. to this company? Or was there a moment where you were like, absolutely not going to even look? Like, did you look at any academic jobs? Did you like poke? Did you do any searches for any kind of clinical jobs? Just kind of curious as to how you were thinking about your career trajectory.
All throughout, I was always open to all. Academic, clinical, and then when consulting came in the mix mm-hmm. around my second or third year, I was open to that. I feel like over time of like doing the student advocacy work that I was doing, my openness to remaining in academia started to decrease because of all of the politics that I was seeing in the space. And I was like, I just don't want to be a part of this, you know, game for real. Like, I want to do the research, but I don't want to have to deal with all this extra stuff. So, yeah, my interest in that started to decrease around, like, you know, towards the end of my tenure, like, as a doctoral student. And then the clinical piece of it, that's something that I'm still interested in. And I actually, when I was applying for different places, I ended up applying to the place that I'm at now, and then I applied to 3 clinical postdocs, and I was accepted into 2 of them. I actually had accepted one of them, and thankfully I was pretty honest with them in the interview that I also have an interest in consulting and long term, like want to do this and do clinical work on the side. So I still, you know, left that on like good terms, but I did end up having to go back to them and let them know like my kind of like dream opportunity opened up and I really want to take this. And I'm still, you know, going to pursue getting my psychology licensure so that I can practice as a licensed psychologist. And, you know, I plan to reach back out to them at some point because they were, it was like a joint group practice that they created, 2 Black women who I really admire the work that they do. So yeah, over time, like the academic one decreased. I still do want to do research at some point, but just not within the academic setting. I know that there are organizations that do community-based research, and I think I would feel more that like that aligns with my values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Totally makes sense. So since you currently work with developing leaders and executive talent, you know, how do you ensure that your consulting work is culturally sustainable and contributes to global Black liberation? Do you encounter any Black leaders mm-hmm. in your client work? And if not, how are you kind of making sure that you're inserting ideas of cultural competency and anti-racism into the consulting work?
That is a really tough one, because by virtue of how like white and patriarchal the spaces are, I don't interact with a lot of Black leaders. And part of that is, you know, as I'm also learning a lot more about the IO space now that I'm in it, and looking into the research in that, there are a lot of companies that have what they call like adverse impact. There's not, you know, the number of Black folks that interview versus what they have in the organization does not match up. And that's something that in a way really aligns with some of the research that I did during my doctoral program of, you know, from more of a clinical standpoint of wanting to do work with relations like of ongoing like healing and culturally relevant and sustainable like interventions for Black folks that contribute to Black liberation. But within this space, I think I'm still trying to actually figure out what that can look like. Some of the ways that that has come up so far is like with the assessment work that we do, there's a lot of talk about how valid, not necessarily how valid they are, but the impact that it has for Black people when organizations are using assessments that maybe are not fully vetted in terms of how much they've been tested on Black folks. And I feel like I'm forgetting the word that I'm trying to use, like the impact it has on them. But that's something that, has come up in conversation. And for the work that I do and the person who's like my direct leader, we have a lot of conversations about that, because there are times where I've even noticed with some of our international candidates, like the assessments that we use, we thankfully have us as humans behind the scenes looking through the data and actually writing the reports and having the conversations with the companies. So it's not just like an AI generated thing that's going out to them, but I'm always having conversations with them about like, I think there might be a cultural component here. This is what it is. So on an individual level, like I do that, but I think me entering into this new field, I'm realizing that there's a larger issue that does need to be addressed, just in terms of like how it's having a systemic impact on folks who are Black and could be very successful in the workplace, but maybe companies are not actually giving them a fair chance.
Right. Well, we're looking forward to continuing to follow along this work, this transformative work that you're doing with your counseling psychology background, developing leaders, developing talent. We hope that you get to do more of that in our community, since that's something that is also important to you. So as we start to wind down, we'd love to know, what is one thing that you would do differently, if any, during your doctoral journey?
I remember like seeing this question when Sarah and I first spoke, and I was like, I don't know.
Is this no regrets for you? I love that. I mean, if it's no regrets.
I do feel like how my journey went, like it, I feel like I was led in a way that makes me feel like I was doing stuff in a way that was like fulfilling and like authentic to who I am. I will say though that I, even though I was very much like on the student advocacy tip, I would say that I wish that I didn't feel as scared to speak up about certain things, which I did end up for the most part speaking up about, but there's such a, like a difference in hierarchy and the power system or the power differential between faculty and students. But I mean, with some of the things that were going on like within the graduate program and the larger university, I feel like it wasn't, it's not worth it to try to mince like how we advocate for students, especially Black students and other students who are at a disadvantage for the sake of, you know, whatever could happen due to that fear. So I think that's the only thing that I would change, is just like being more vocal about certain things.
Right. Yeah, that's very similar to the advice that Dr. Shelly-Ann Gajadhar gave. I talked to her yesterday, so it's like very much on my mind. But she said something similar that was like, don't sacrifice your authenticity for likability. So like, don't kind of hold yourself back from being your true self and for advocating and for speaking up just so that you can be liked. So that really closely aligns with what she said too. So what is one final piece of advice that you have for current or prospective Black women and non-binary doctoral students? Yeah,
this one I would say, like, it's hard because every program is kind of different and different demands, but coming from a program where, you know, I had to juggle a lot of different things and my weekly hours were super maxed out, I would say to not sacrifice your personal, like, self-care, mental health time, social life, like find a way to continue to incorporate that in whatever you're doing, because the degree is not worth your mental health or your happiness or, you know, anything else that is going on. Like, obviously there's things that we'll miss. Like, I experienced so much loss and so much celebration that I missed out on being around family for, but I tried my best to make sure that I was still maintaining like my life outside of academia, because that is more so what life is about. Like, this degree is a part of who I am. And so I think it's important to continue to maintain those aspects of our identity and what makes us like happy and going, so that we can be able to get out of the program with, you know, some sort of semblance of sanity and health.
Yes. Yeah. Just like the teeniest drop of sanity. Right. If we can finish with just a little bit of sanity left, then we've done a good job. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Onwunga, for joining us today on the Cohort Sisters podcast. It's been a joy and pleasure speaking with you and learning more about how you've applied your research to your current work. I hope that other people learn and take some gems away from your journey and continue to follow along with you.
I really appreciate you creating this space. Like, when I first found it, I'm like, I don't even know how she got to figuring all this stuff out, but we need it. So I really appreciate it. And you, Dr. Colon.
Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of the Cohort Sisters podcast. If you are a Black woman interested in joining the Cohort Sisters membership community, or you're looking for more information on how to support or partner with Cohort Sisters, please visit our website at www.cohortsisters.com. You can also find us on all social media platforms at Cohort Sisters. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cohort Sisters podcast and leave us a quick review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and we'll catch you in next week's episode.